Hello and a very warm welcome to another episode of the Get Football Tactics podcast. I'm your host Neil Shelath and I'm delighted to say that I have been joined once again by Varun Vasudevan. How are you, Varun?
I'm good. I had a nice break last week. You guys took care of the Las Palmas episode pretty brilliantly. I had fun listening to you. So I got a break. I got recharged. I have done some research and I'm ready and back with some analysis for today.
Yeah, he's done some research. He's absolutely filled up the doc. And we've already got Alex Barker disagreeing with a lot of what he said. So how are you doing, Alex? Are you ready for a good debate?
Yeah, I am, you know. I think this is... I mean, the man we're going to be talking about, we'll touch on in a second. When I went to do my research, I went in with the most positive of intentions. So just a disclaimer, everything I'm about to say... are things that I never thought I would be saying.
Wow. Okay. I mean, it's very surprising that you went in with a positive outlook for one.
No. I mean, him going in positive, him going in positive and coming out negative sounds like the usual.
That's perfectly normal. Yes. Sir.
Yeah. Maybe I should go to a doctor. It's a bit unlike
me. anyway, let's get into it. As the title suggests, we are talking about Sporting Clube de Portugal today, and the big reason we are doing that is because their manager, Ruben Amorim, is, well, the talk of the town, really. He's being linked to a lot of jobs. Has been for a while, but I think there's a lot of interest once again this summer when we expect a lot of managers to leave and so a lot of big jobs to be open. And he spent a good deal of time at Sporting now. I think he'll be almost 4 years this summer. So let's just get a quick bit of background about him. He played in Portugal mostly at Benfica as a player, had a stint at Braga as well. And then soon enough, after sort of retiring in a couple of years, moved into management. His first job, I think, was in Casa Pia, who are now a Primeira Liga club. But at the time, I believe they were in the third tier. But then he got an offer from Braga, of course, whom he played with. First took over their B team. But after the main team manager was sacked, he got the job on an interim basis and he did really, really well. So much so that in under a year, Sporting approached him because they sacked their manager as well. And they signed him. And obviously they bought him out of his contract. So they paid 10 million euros to sign him from Braga, which was, I believe, one of the highest transfer fees for a manager at the time. Of course, it's been broken now with Graham Potter and all that. But I mean, especially in Portugal, that's a big deal of money. Like, that's in 10 million euros, you can get a pretty good player. So clearly shows how well rated he was, even with relatively less experience, less than a year in senior football. And then he had a very, very instant impact in his first full season at Sporting. He won them their first Primeira Liga title in, I think it was about 2 decades or closer to 2 decades. And since then, they've not gone badly at all. They finished second the following season. I think last season was the biggest drop-off, I would say. They went down to fourth. But this season, they're doing a decent job in the Europa League and they're back firmly in the title race. I think they are... they've played one game. They're going to play it tonight as we record this. So if they win, they will go 1 point above Benfica at the top. And of course, they also defeated Benfica in the cup just this week. So they're on course to compete on about 3 or 4 fronts. So clearly having a successful time there, but a lot to dig in as far as his tactics are concerned. So I think we shouldn't beat around the bush. Let's just dive straight into it. Of course, as one of the big three clubs, as a manager at one of the big three or four clubs in Portugal, Sporting will dominate games more often than not. So the first thing to focus on, I think, has to be how they operate in possession. Now, over his almost, 3-4 years at Sporting, Amorim has stuck to a back three and a 3-4-3 formation throughout. So in possession, this becomes a 3-2-5. Or especially in the last 2 or so years, quite often a 3-1-6 even, as one of the double pivot pushes up. And I think the movements of these midfielders are quite interesting because when they play the sort of 3-1-6 style, the free midfielder will, you know, often push up, but also sometimes he might pull wide to help play out on the wing, mostly on the left, and sometimes even drop back and free up a center back. So that's one interesting aspect I find. The other thing is it's a pretty expansive style they play. So they do stretch the pitch wide quite a bit. Both their wing backs you'll generally see on the touchline. And then what I like is how they vary their height to help progress the ball. So they'll generally try and start high. They may drop back to offer passes. And again, depending on who their opponents are and how they want to play, that'll also impact not just the height of the wing backs, but also how wide the inside forwards or wingers, whatever you want to call them, are. And yeah, I mean, I do enjoy watching their possession play. I think they're definitely a fun team to watch. And yeah, I think that's a very basic idea of how they play 3-2-5, 3-1-6. Very expansive, stretching the pitch fully, and just looking to pass their way through opponents and create in the final third. So that is a rough idea of what they do. I think Varun has some stuff to add before Alex brings in the concerns. So Varun, let's get into that.
Yeah, I think you covered the build-up stuff pretty well. And there is that difference, right? When earlier they would build up in a 3-1-6 with Ugarte, the emphasis also was on forming that kind of diamond with the center back and the two wide center backs and the defensive midfielder. And then once Ugarte or one of the wide center backs gets a bit of space, they can reach out to the front five. So the patterns were a little more simplistic, I would say. And since then, he's added a lot more variation and a lot more difference in the style in which they build up. As you said, there's now a double pivot. And the center back also pushes into midfield often in the build-up phase. So the central center back is almost like a defensive midfielder. Lots of times you'll find that there's almost a midfield triangle with the pivot and the center back. And the wide center backs are very wide, almost like in fullback areas. And the goalkeeper is in the central center back position. So they're almost like forming a wide back three chain and a midfield trio in the middle. And then there are the front five who are also occupying all the lanes and can drop from the half spaces. So lot more variations, lot more options. And it's testament to the back three and how skilled they are that they can step into midfield, they can go wide like fullbacks, and the midfielders are also very involved. So these are some of like some really nice build-up variations that are now coming up. And like a lot of teams, they tend to spread really wide in the build-up, stretch the opponent press, then start going narrow. And it's in the final third where they do try and attack a bit more narrow. The wingers, although we call them, they're almost like attacking midfielders. You know, they're mostly in the half spaces and they're not the ones providing the width. The wing backs, when they bomb forward, are the ones providing the width. So the wingers, I would say, are almost like two number 10s. And the striker now with Gyökeres, they get a very, very vertical angle as well. So lots of times they do a bit of build up and tiki-taka, but if the option is there, they go direct. They go direct to the striker. They now have that option where they can start going directly to a physical striker as well. And a very common attacking pattern is when they enter the opponent half, they go into that 3-1-6, as you said, where there's one defensive midfielder who's hovering near the central center back. The wide center backs are very wide. And there's this bank of five and then the striker in the box. So it's like super attacking and they camp in the opponent half and they almost suffocate them there. On the biases, they have a slight left side bias during the build-up and a right side bias in the final third. So a lot of teams have this, right? They will go towards one side where some of their better build-up players are and then kind of switch and tilt it when they're in the attacking phase where their better outlets are. So I think the left side bias is there in build-up. That's where a few of their players drop a bit more and then they switch a bit more to the right side. And lastly, I would say in the variations, depending on which players play, they are able to do different variations. Sometimes they build up in a 2-4. I've seen a lot of times it almost feels like a back four and then a pivot. And then the fullbacks step up to create a 2-4 structure. then sometimes there's a diamond in midfield where, again, similar to the 3-1-6, there's one pivot, but then there are two midfielders who drop deep as well. We saw this a lot when Diomande was not there during AFCON, and they were able to play a diamond without him. So when the backups keep coming in, the rotation players keep coming in, these patterns change to suit them. So I do feel Amorim has that flexibility. He takes the player's traits into account, what they can do. He obviously takes the opposition pressing structures into account. So I do think the way they progress and attack, they have enough variations to keep it fresh.
Right. Now, Alex, what's your problem?
All of this sounds so nice. What is your bloody problem, Alex?
I feel like the Grim Reaper. It's great. So I don't disagree with anything you guys have said. I think you very well outlined what they do in build-up, particularly how it's flexible. Just another one to throw in there. I think they also, what I quite like from watching them, is the centre-backs hitting cross-field balls to the wingers, but the wing-back rather, because they're always so wide. Like, that option's always there, and the wing-back always can receive in quite a ton of space. My main problem is I just think you can't do it in the Premier League. I think... A lot of it relies on, as we said, when they get into this 3-1-6, is because one of the midfielders, as Neil said, like, often pulls wide to form these like triangles. And like, it's good to create wide overloads, but it does literally leave one midfielder and a narrow back three. And if that back three isn't the best in the league, or like upware of the best in the league, like, it's just going to cause so many problems. They're currently getting away with it with Sebastian Coates in there, right? I think Diomande and Inashao are, like, from what I've seen, they look very good. But just to reiterate the early point of our research I was looking at, like, Sporting gives like a squad value, I think, around 200 million, I believe. Like, I think 14 out of the 18 sides in Portugal have a squad value below 50 million euros. Like, they're not just one of the most dominant teams. It's just an incredibly top-heavy team. I think that's got to be, I haven't compared it necessarily, but I think that's like way more weighted than Ligue 1, for example, or the Bundesliga, two leagues that would often be called, like, you know, leagues dominated from the top. So I think his flexibility is nice. I just think he's got so much room to be flexible. And my concern would be if you went to a top league where teams could catch out, for example, if you lose the ball, and like while you're building up, while your midfielder is out wide, or while like Morita is one of the midfielders who often pushes up in to the forward line to make this sort of 3-1-6, like if you lose the ball in those scenarios, suddenly you're in massive trouble, in my opinion. So I think this is a big problem. Well, not necessarily a big problem. I think it's a big concern. Like, maybe it could work. I think if you were at Manchester City, it probably would work. But I'd be like shocked if he could move to, I don't know, the teams that would be compared at the moment, Liverpool and Chelsea. I'd be shocked if he could move to one of those teams and like be minimally exposed as he is right now.
Yeah, I mean, I see where you're coming from. But I think, and I agree in the sense that if you copy paste this system into the Premier League, you're probably going to get run through. But I just think he's not, I mean, I don't expect him to do that, because from what I've seen of him, from what I've read of his interviews and stuff, he doesn't strike me as the sort of, I think Warren and I were discussing this just before we hit record. He doesn't strike us as like the Peter Bosz type of guy who's like, I don't care what's going to happen. I'm going to play this way. You can run through my team every 2 minutes in transition. I don't care. We're still going to play this way. I think Amorim is a bit more adaptable. I can't seem to think of the right words. Adaptable is sort of there, but basically what I'm trying to say is that he understands the and respects the situations a bit more. So he understands what sort of players he's got on the pitch, and equally he understands what sort of opposition he's facing. And you're right, I mean, the Portuguese league is, and there's a big disparity between the top teams and the lower teams, right? So that's why he can do this. And if you can do this, why shouldn't you do this? Because, like, you know, if you can blow through teams with six up top, then without sort of being exposed in transition, then just do it. Because it'll get you one of the best attacks in the league, which is what they have. So I think that's why he's doing it there. But if you look at sort of Sporting in Champions League games or Europa League games this season, or even against the likes of Porto and Benfica, I think you see a more measured and restrained approach in those games. And I feel that that's what will translate. That's what he will rather bring to whatever team he goes to in a higher league. And equally, the other thing which I like is how he understands his players. Like last season, they were, especially towards the end, they were almost exclusively playing the 3-1-6 we talked about, because they had Ugarte as the one holding midfielder who's an absolute monster when it comes to like covering ground and sort of basically cutting down counterattacks. But then after he left this season, initially especially, they played with a 3-2-5 a lot more, like in the early weeks. But then eventually, I think Hjulmand grew into that role and Amorim saw that he was getting comfortable. So now, I think especially in 2024, I'd say, they've largely again gone back to that 3-1-6. So I think he's a bit more sort of flexible, understanding of what he's got to work with. And that's why I think, I mean, it's a valid concern, but I don't think it's something that we should be worried too much about, because I expect him to adapt appropriately to whatever team he takes charge of.
Let's take that he adapts appropriately. Let's say he moves to like the Premier League. Let's say he moves there and he recognises he can't do this 3-1-6. He recognises he can't be as expensive as you say. And from what I've gathered, he's also a smart, adaptable coach. Let's say he recognises I can't do that. Let's go to the 3-2. Let's be a bit more conservative. Do you still back him to break down these low blocks? But what if this is his answer towards that question? And if you take this away from him, because he takes it away himself because he knows it will cause him problems, does he still find a way to break down deep sitting defences? That's the worrying question I find. Like, more so than, like, yeah, I don't necessarily think he's a Petr Bosz, but if he moves to the Premier League and he's like, yeah, like, he might get caught in that middle ground of, I need to adapt my system because I can't necessarily do it the way I've been doing it in Portugal, but suddenly I'm finding it a lot more difficult to break down defences.
Varun, you have your hand up?
Yeah, I mean, actually this brings me to another point, and the same point, but I'm just approaching it in a different way, and I now want to throw this question to you guys. There are basically different approaches to breaking down a stubborn block, right? And I think there was an excellent thread on Twitter, I forgot by whom, on the importance of not rushing things or being patient, and how Bayern have not shown that this year. It was about mainly about mentality and how players, in when they get frustrated, they start going direct, they start getting throwing players ahead. And I think that's a question in general I have. Some managers, when they are faced with a stubborn block, like imagine a very deep West Ham and, you know, nice organized 4-4-2 or 5-3-2, and you're just not getting any joy in progressing through them. So what is the answer? And some managers go towards one extreme where they just go like, throw one more player forward, make it 3-1-6, spread it out more, go direct, start putting crosses in, start going, like, just be more aggressive, you know, break down the block, like literally break it down with aggression. And other managers have a different approach where they just get in a few more players in midfield, maybe invert another center back into midfield, pass a bit more, stretch the block a bit more, emphasize more patience, more control, more movement, so that the block is slowly displaced and then they can, you know, play that key pass or through ball or whatever. And I think it's basically a philosophical question. And I think Amorim leans towards the first. His answers to a lot of these block-breaking situations are, you know, more width, more directness, more players, and, you know, more aggression. I'm not sure that's always the right answer. I'm not sure often that's the right answer when you're faced with a very organized block, which will happen with the best teams in the world, which will happen in the Premier League, which will happen in better leagues than the Portuguese league. So I do share Alex's concern in that sense. What if you're repeatedly faced with a block and your only answer is more players, more directness, and throwing the kitchen sink?
Yeah, that's a fair concern. And I think sort of one thing which I want to point out is that when we think of sort of the way Amorim is playing, and like when you hear 3-1-6, you think that, okay, like that's, you know, top heavy, very attacking approach. But quick question for you guys. So in the three full seasons that Amarim's been in charge of Sporting, plus this one, the current one, how many times do you think they have had the best XG in the league? And how many times do you think they have had the best XGA in the league?
I think it's going to be really, I think it's going to be like nearly every season, but I'm just going to point to league quality towards that.
No. But just answer the question. I'll get on to that.
Best XG for and against?
Yeah. No, how, like each individually. So do you think it's like 3 times best XG and 2 times best XGA? Or how do you think?
Oh God. No. I'm not sure they had the best XG for last season. I'll go 3 times XG, the best XG against, 2 times the best XG for.
Okay, Varun?
Something similar. I think XGA would be a little better, but maybe not all three. Probably 2 times best XG or 1 time best XG.
The correct answer is 0 times best XG and 3 times best XGA. And what I'm trying to say through that is that I think maybe we don't give Amarim enough credit for the way he gets his team to control games. Because while he does play this 3-1-6, he's got the best defensive record in the league in every season except the last one. And I think a lot of that is down to just how they keep control possession, how they retain the ball, how they counter press, and equally, the point you made about the league, which is the fact that in Portugal, teams will often defend really, really deep, obviously in a low block. You'll see back fives. You'll even see against these big teams, back sixes. So teams that traditionally play, let's say, a 4-5-1, you'll even see them drop into like a 6-3-1 with both wingers tracking back, especially against Sporting's, you know, very high wing backs. You'll see teams sink deep into like with 9 players basically in and around their box. And so I think what he gets in Portugal by playing this very expansive, very attacking approach is it's not just putting a lot of his players in the final third. It's also pushing back a lot of the opponents into their own third and basically removing their counter-attacking threat to a large extent. And I think that is, I mean, obviously that is the end product, but I also think that is his intention with these tactics. So I do think he, to the point Varun made, I think the reason he is what I'm basically answering here is that I think the reason he's being so expansive and he's putting so many people forward is to push people back. So now obviously the point Alex made about in the Premier League where there's, let's just say, better defenses and better defenders, which is true. How do you break that down? I think what I expect is that his attack will not be so good. Like they won't be scoring, what, 2 goals a game or something, 2-3 goals a game, which is, I mean, to be fair, like any Premier League team except Manchester City is not going to do that. But I don't think he will be sort of stuck in no man's land, like not a good attack, but not a good defense. I think he will understand like well enough to prioritize something. And generally you'd expect that will be the defense. But I don't mean the defense as in out of possession like Chelsea are doing right now. I mean in terms of like securely sort of controlling possession and trying to control games that way. So personally, I think that is the main thing that Amarim wants with the ball. Not to the extent of Guardiola, of course, not nearly. But I think he's not just a very attacking manager, as his formations, his player selections might lead you to believe.
I don't think we could talk about defence without now talking about their out of possession, to be honest, which I think you're primed to talk about.
All right, let's get into it. I think I'm sure you have more problems.
Yeah, this is going to be fiery, this one, because just for this, in the doc, I've noticed that both Varun and Neil disagree with what I'm about to say. Neil says his piece.
Okay, yeah, so just let's again just go with a quick bit of context before your problems come in. So as I said, Sporting's formation generally is 3-4-3s, and that's usually what you see with them out of possession. Against most teams, they will look to press high, especially against the non-top four teams in Portugal. You'll see 3-4-3 high press, pretty expansive. They'll commit almost 5-6 people to pressing. And then, so you'll have the front three, obviously, plus the wing backs on the when the ball comes to the wing, basically, and plus one midfielder as well, quite often. So that's five or six people committed to the press. When, of course, that again, the question there is what happens if someone plays through the front five or six or whatever. So you'll also have centre backs jumping a lot into midfield to win duels, like they'll track their strikers or whatever forwards really closely into midfield. But then they also drop into a really good compact block, which I don't think people give them enough credit for, because again, especially in games against the likes of Benfica and Porto and Braga, and even in sort of games against lower teams, which they're like 2-0, 3-0 up and they're trying to see out, they have a really nice compact mid block. It's often a 5-3-2 actually, because they'll play with Gonçalves in the nominal left wing, left forward position, but he'll drop into midfield. But of course, it can also be a 5-2-2-1 or a 5-2-3, you know, with, again, a very compact center. So that's the main focus of their block, is the front five are going to be very compact in the middle and just force the opponents wide where they can be restricted. And yeah, there's obviously match-to-match tweaks. So, you know, sometimes it'll be more of a 3-4-1-2 than a 3-4-3 press. Again, depending on the opposition, how they're building up and that sort of stuff. So yeah, personally, I like it. I think he is quite clever with his out of possession approach, Amorim, and he sets his side up well. But Alex does not think so. What do you think, Alex?
Yeah, so three disclaimers. Firstly, okay. From the games I've watched, I ended up watching, like, I've watched a few sporting games over the past, but this week I watched five games very much in depth, and that were a mix of teams lower in the table and a couple of big games. So the main ones off the top of my head were Benfica and Atalanta. So Benfica last year, Atalanta's 1-1 draw with them in the Europa League group stages. Second point, unlike in possession, where I think there's concerns about how it could translate to the Premier League, I think this is actually an active problem. And I think Sporting actually have problems in the way they press that aren't getting exposed. So this third point before I start, I'm genuinely looking to convince both of you on this. So it's going to be hard to do this without visuals. But essentially, Sporting just give up way too much space when they press. And they don't. I don't think they adapt it well enough for big teams. So I took most of my screenshots for the video I did for The Athletic for the game versus Benfica, where Sporting press in this front three, which they consistently do, unlike other teams where you might drop a forward into the midfield, Sporting don't do that. And I think the reason Amorim does this is because he wants his front three to be further forward, like in more advantageous positions, say Sporting win the ball, so then they could quickly get the ball to them and, you know, create attacking opportunities to score.
Yeah, they're the most goal-ending high turnovers in the league.
Yeah, there we go. That does not surprise me in the slightest for how high they keep their front line. But this place is like a giant burden on their midfielders. Morten Thunlund and Hidemasa Morita. And also, like, before we talk about that necessarily, actually, I've got problems further on, but yeah, the emphasis is based on those two midfielders is because this front three press really high. But once the ball goes past them, they become quite passive. So you've got this dead space between as far as the defenders can step up, which is probably like 20 yards past their defensive line before they you know, it's just a bit suicidal. And then between the dead press of the forwards, you've now got the midfielders having to cover everywhere. So let's say a midfielder pulls wide, Morita or Human will have to track that. Otherwise, you know, the opposition break the press. Then now there's just one person in this entire space in midfield. And I don't think this is something that Amorim is, like, gambling on necessarily. I think it's just a problem. Against Atalanta's first goal and their 1-1 draw, like, they get punished for this poor pressing. Like, as they just build way through pressure and then score a screamer, in fairness, but still. I think there's other problems that are harder to explain. For example, their wingbacks tend to start really deep when they press. Like they won't press the opposition like fullback or like wide player, until they're about to receive the ball. So like you often see like these weird situations where Katamo or Santos on the left, like the opposition player's receiving the ball and they're making like a 30-yard sprint to close the ball down. And you're just looking, like, I was watching a back and feed game with John McKenzie, and like even he was just like, what are they doing? Like, I just don't understand this. So I think Varane's got some stuff to say, so maybe we can go back to me on that. But that is like my opening statement. I think they should be punished a lot more for the way they press, and they aren't enough. Even those opposition teams are still finding weaknesses in it. I think the only reason you can justify doing it is for those high turnovers. But if you do anything like this on a more regular basis against like better quality teams, either lows like that are meant to be above you or lows meant to be below you, you'll get eaten apart.
Yeah.
Over to you, Varun.
I'm going to come in and I kind of disagree. And I don't disagree with your observations. I mean, they're all fair observations and that is what happens. So not disagreeing on that. But I disagree on the intent, the philosophy and the logic. I don't think it's because he's unaware. I don't think it's because he's limited. I don't think it's because he doesn't know better. So that's where I disagree. I think, see, with any pressing structure, I mean, if we just talk philosophically, the idea is how you're balancing risk and reward, right? You're always going to leave space somewhere. And you just have to balance that with the reward you're getting in with respect to it. And I think Amorim has a good idea of that. I mean, there's a reason the XG numbers are so good. There's a reason. I mean, you take any defensive numbers, they're open play, XG, open play goals, open play shots. They're the best in the league for all of them. Entries into the final third, they are the best for all of them. All his defensive metrics are better than his offensive metrics. And I think the reason is because Amorim has that sense of what he's risking. And just talking about the press, I do think them allowing balls into those wide areas is their pressing trap. I mean, you just mentioned, why are they letting the ball go wide and why is the wing back not pressing earlier? And why is the front three also way intense but a bit more narrow? I think that is the trap. They often press intensely but narrowly because they want to funnel the ball wide and they don't make the wing back jump until someone's caught it wide, and then a midfielder, a wing back, and maybe if possible an inside forward, all three jump in that wide area when someone is cornered without options. That is the trap. And I'm not saying it always works. And as you said, if there's a really good team that can play around it, it can be circumvented, but it happens rarely. According to me, it happens rarely from those wide areas, someone quickly building up, going in and taking advantage of those spaces that Sporting leave. It doesn't happen as much as you'd like. And again, I don't think Amorim is sitting there thinking, no team's ever going to do that against me, so I'm fine. I'm sure he's aware. It just doesn't happen as much. And that is where I think he takes that risk. He gets the turnovers, the counters for the risk he's taking. He mostly defends well, and their pressing trap does succeed 90% of the time. The 5% of the time it doesn't succeed, they also are able to organize into a block. And this is where I differentiate him from some other managers, where they are able to recover as well. Their recovery, I mean, and again, you can say this is because the back three have a lot of, you know, speed and physicality. But again, it's him recognizing that he still has another layer of protection, where a spread out, stepping up back three, the wide center back can always step up if the wing back and the number eight are not able to trap there. So all those things also help. So I think he's doing it with the understanding that he can take these risks and get away with it 95% of the time. And yes, 5%, there is a chance where all of it works against them. A team builds up really well, the wide trap doesn't work, the back three is exposed in a 3v3 and they get the better of them and they're able to score as well. And that will happen. I mean, that happens with most teams. I think, again, coming back to Neil's point, he will make these adjustments when he goes to a better league. He knows he won't be able to isolate his pivot or his back three so often. He knows he won't be able to press with the front three so intensely, knowing that, you know, if there is space, he can leave it on the wide and then he can manage it later. Given the changes he keeps making out of possession, the way he's able to drop into a mid block, the way his pressing variations also change, it's not like he always presses in that three forwards and two midfielders. Sometimes they press in a 2-4 or a 4-2. Sometimes they're very narrow. So he does have those variations. So I just think, again, while they are very valid observations, if you think from a philosophical point of view, he knows the risk he's taking. And I think he will adjust the risk he's taking in his next club or in his next job. It's not a case of this guy just knows one way to press and he'll be eaten alive the moment he does the same thing somewhere else. I just don't think it's a case of that. What do you think, Neil?
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I'm somewhere between both of you in this respect. So I think what you said about the explanation for the wing backs being so deep and stuff, it totally makes sense. And I think, yeah, again, this goes back to the league they're in. So in Portugal, even like obviously some teams will just play direct from goal kicks, but even from the lower table, there's a fair few teams who will try and play out, but they will not take risks, especially against Sporting, right? So if your wing back is already high and you're pressing with the front three, then their center back is going to be very hesitant to pass to the full back if he can see the wing back right behind his back. So it's a trap, as you said. They're laying this trap and they're really encouraging that wide pass because they want it to be played so that they jump and press. Will he do that in sort of a Premier League? Well, no, probably not, because he knows like all Premier League fullbacks, almost all of them.
Yeah, I mean, if he does that against Liverpool and he gives that against, like, pace, yeah, they'll just kill him. Well. Yeah. I don't think he'll do that. I mean,
exactly. Yeah, and that's what I was going to, is that I don't think he's, and again, I, to be fair, I have notice this in big games, but I do take the point that Alex makes, though, which is that he hasn't shown a different pressing structure for big games. For example, like when we are talking about the in possession stuff, we said that yes, he plays 3-1-6 a lot, but then in big games he will go to that 3-2-5, be a little bit more sort of have a stronger base with the three and the two back there, so five people in the rest defense structure, let's say. But I haven't seen anything a really different pressing structure from him in big games. So I think this is a slightly more of a concern. I don't think it's a total red flag, to be honest, but I think it's a concern. Because in big games, like if I'm watching Sporting in a big game, whether it's against Benfica in the league or Atalanta or whoever in the Europa League, I think they're better. Or even in the Champions League, like last season, I remember I was covering their game against Tottenham, what, last season or 2 seasons ago or whenever. But yeah, the point is, in those games, if I'm more confident when Sporting are dropping into the mid block that I mentioned, which is really centrally compact, and he does that well, to be honest. In most games, he does do that. But then, like Alex said, sometimes they will press and then they will get played through. And I haven't seen an adapted pressing structure for these games, for these Benficas and Atalantas, which makes me think that he will have an immediate answer if he moves to the Premier League. So what I think will happen is, if you put him in a Premier League team right now, I think his team will become much more of a block team, like a less pressing team, not a low block team. They will try and sort of restrict territory as much as they can. But I don't expect them to press a lot. I do think he's a really clever manager from what I've seen and read. He understands opponents and tactics really well. So I do think he will come up with something at some point. But like right now where Amorim is, and again, remember, he's what, 39 years old? So he's got a lot of time ahead of him. But yeah, like if you put Amorim in the Premier League today, I don't think people will think of him as a pressing manager, because I don't think he's got a pressing structure that works in the Premier League right now. And to me, I think that he has had the scope to show it. He doesn't show it every week, but in those big games, I would have liked to see it. But Alex has his hand up.
Yeah, and like, what I want to make sure as well is clear is I'm not trying to argue that Ruben Amorim is necessarily a bad coach, and the fact he's 39, like, every time I hear that is insane to me. He's so young. My argument is that I don't think he should be moving to like a a team aspiring for big things in the Premier League, like top four or top six, for example, he should be moving to, his next move should be like to a middling club in a top five league, like, or like maybe like, you know, sort of Europa League level team in one of the other big four leagues. Because I think he needs room to make mistakes. Is, yeah, like between the both of you, I think he could change the way his sides press. Like maybe he does think like, okay, I'm only doing this, as Rowan said, like risk and reward. I'm only doing this because the reward in this league is just so high. Like as soon as I move to somewhere else, I have to do a big reset. But let's say it is that scenario. Like I think this is a harder one to reset than you're in possession, which I guess is like might sound weird on paper. Like you think it'd be easier to reset what you do out of possession, because you know, out of possession teams tend to, I think they tend to get coached a little quicker, like when managers take over, right? But it does just seem like a lot of what he's done has relied on this system. Like, even beyond what we're seeing on the pitch, like their last three main central midfielders, João Palhinha, Manuel Ugarte, Morten Thielmann, I think that's a pattern. I think there's a recruitment strategy of, we need to get midfielders who can cover big, large distances because this is the way we're going to press. Like, is he going to, is he going to tweak it? Is he going to sort of abandon it in a sense? Is he going to play a midfield two? I think that is a big question in itself. Is he going to maintain a midfield two out of possession? Like, I think there's, like, the Rowan, I agreed with a lot of what you were saying. I was hearing, I think the one bit I didn't agree with was like the ending point of like saying Sporting have one way to press. I was saying that. I don't necessarily think Sporting have a way to press. I just think they have lots of little things that they would need to change, or they should be changing in a bigger league. And I think things like that will take time. And as Neil's kind of pointed out, like, I think the problem is this is still theory. Like, what's to say right now that the likeliest scenario isn't that he moves to a bigger team and goes, no, I want to press in the front three, but I believe I can get more out of this. I just need to N'Golo Kante to midfield. Like, if we can do that, then we can press really well. And then it just goes horribly wrong. That is, like, based on what we've seen, we have to consider that possibility, which is why, like, I think there should be a red flag around this. Like, it could be a red flag that when you interview him for a job, that might get dispelled quite quickly. If you're able to talk about this and he says, no, I'm going to tweak it, like, I can adapt to these players, we're going to change the structure, like, you know, I'm not just, like, one-trick pony. Like, maybe that red flag can be dispelled, but right now, it is a red flag, and that is my concern.
Yeah, no, that's fair, but I think, what you said last is basically almost sort of the answer, because, like you said, so, if he wants to press this way, he's going to need to N'Golo Kante in midfield, he's not going to get them, and once he doesn't get them, I think he will adapt, he will see that. But let's hold that thought for a moment, because we will discuss where he should go next. But first, I think Warren has some stuff to say about some of the other stuff that Sporting and Amorim have been doing, including the recruitment that you touched upon. So, Warren, let's get that out of the way, and then we'll discuss where he might end up next.
Yeah, I mean, just before the recruitment, I mean, we just spoke so much about tactics, and I just want to touch on his man management aspect, and he's very highly rated for that. He has very good communication. His players speak very well of him. He will defend his players to the death. He manipulates narratives in the press to maintain player confidence. He diverts media attention well. He's a very good communicator. And the control on dressing room is one aspect that has been cited many times, that the squad dynamics are really good, and that's one of his big strengths. I'm just mentioning these because these are really important in a top team. I mean, Nagelsmann said that his job at Bayern was 60-70% communication of ideas and 30-40% tactics that he'd learned, you know, under Ragnik and all. So that is one big reason which separates the good from the great. And yeah, there was a focus on English, Spanish, Portuguese speakers, which was a rule to build these dynamics. Everyone should learn one of these languages, and there are core groups within the club. He I think made this statement. I mean, I'm not going to try and say the Portuguese version and embarrass myself, but it basically translates to, where one goes, we all go. That was his. And that's he made this quote in a presser, and since then that's been like the campaign name or the headline. There are banners around it. There's like social media slogans around it because it sums up his teamwork dynamic. And he does focus a lot on training, on good personalities. There are examples of players who've been sidelined by Amorim for failing to adhere to standards. Ruben Venagre, Islam Slimani, Gonzalo Plata. I mean, these are players that were sidelined very quickly because they were not giving their best effort. And on the opposite side, a lot of young players who really do well. Age and status doesn't matter to him. He's able to give young players a chance if they really do well in training. So these kind of rules make it easier for the players also to adapt around him, and for the fans, the board, everyone to work around him. So just wanted to get that in. The social dynamics he brings as a communicator, as a leader, they're pretty good. I mean, everything I've read so far, they've been super impressive. I think that will really help at a top team. And yeah, the last thing I want to touch on before we close tactics is, I mean, Alex mentioned this, they have an amazing squad, and all said and done, some of the recruitment work Sporting have done, I mean, all the three Portuguese clubs do great recruitment work. Sporting have been killing it recently. If you just look at their arrivals last summer, I mean, there's a reason they've kind of jumped up this summer after an average year last year. Gyökeres from Coventry, I thought, was a very good signing. He was pretty well rated in the championship, and I thought he would get a Premier League move, at least to a bottom half team, right? To one of those Nottingham, West Ham kind of clubs. And that was a very good capture by Sporting. Hjelmand has been a revelation. I mean, just that midfield going from Palinha to Ugarte to Hjelmand, I mean, that is amazing. And as Alex said, there is a type, but it's also a testament to the fact that the recruitment team is able to stay to that type and keep getting the next best young player of that type. You know, it's not normal. You could just end up with a slightly defensive midfielder, slightly different defensive midfielder, and it could all fall apart. But Sporting haven't allowed that happen. Fresneda, again, so well-rated. A lot of people are saying he should go to Barca or United or Madrid, or, you know, one of the top clubs, and Sporting got him from Valladolid. Trincao from Barcelona, he was well-rated. I thought he was not used well, and he didn't get his chances. He's done a little better at Sporting. He's not a starter, but then he does have talent. And I mean, they have been getting recruitment well. Morita just came for 3 million the previous year. Arthur Gomez has also helped. So I do think, and then they've sold really well. Ugarte for 60 million, Pedro Porro for 40 million. I think they're rough. I read this somewhere that their rough intention is to use 50% of the transfer money they bring in into incoming. So like even last year, they gained 123 million from transfers and spent 60 million. The previous year, they sold 132 million and they spent 55 million. So it's a very, very, very tight equation, 50% of what they sell, and they constantly sell 100 million plus, and they constantly buy 50, 60 million. So very well run in terms of finances, very well run in terms of recruitment. They always know what they're doing. Even some of the sales when they're last minute, like Nunes went in the last minute to Wolves. It was after promising that he won't go, and a clash before Porto a few days before the deadline window, they lost Nunes and they quickly replaced him. So it's just very well run. They deal with random transfers and setbacks well. It just shows that they have their lists ready, they have their scouting network well spread out, and they're always active in the market. So very well-run club from a recruitment and squad-building point of view.
Yep, I think that's spot on. So with all of that being said, the big question, of course, on everyone's mind is where Amorim will go. We can't say that. But where Amorim should go, we might be able to hazard or give an option or two. So anyone with any ideas to start us off?
Not Alex. Chelsea, and then you're fine.
Okay, but where then? Would you say like Liverpool or...
not Liverpool.
You just want him to stay at home? Not Chelsea.
I'm looking at the Premier League. If we're fan casting him, which is, I think, you know, the fun. Do you know what could be a fun shout? West Ham.
Nope, no chance. Absolutely not.
I've only put 3 seconds thought into it.
Yeah, that's the third choice I think it's a disease spreading around all of us. Because third time is
like
bad.
One so much.
First time is bad. It will end badly. So to the points you made, Alex, some of which I do agree with. I think what it shows is that it would be best for Amorim if he moves to a top, like a more dominant team. I don't think he's the right person to take a team from, especially the way West Ham are playing, to the way he wants to play, which are almost polar opposites. I don't think he's the right person for that transition.
So I actually disagree, because I feel like he shouldn't be going to a team. If he goes to a dominant team...
I think he should go to Liverpool, actually.
No, I think big disagree. I think the expectations are way too high there. He's
a higher Sporting as well.
Yeah, but he's 39 too. Like, we've had a lot of problems. I think he's going to make mistakes in the Premier League. I'm not saying he can't be great in future. In fact, I think it's likely he'll be Liverpool level in future. But imagine Roberto De Zerbi moves to Liverpool in the summer. Like, there's lots of problems.
There's a lot of people saying he should do that. And the only concerns are tactical.
Yeah, there's a lot of tactical problems with his Brighton team. Imagine they were at Liverpool. There'd be such a more glaring light.
So here's why I think he should go to Liverpool. I think the transition is better because he's... I mean, they don't play tactically similar, but stylistically it's similar, the way they play. Super intense pressing, you get from both counter-pressing, you get from both expansive possession play, you get from both, especially this season, because Liverpool have also become very expansive. And, the point of expectation, there's going to be expectation everywhere. Like, even at West Ham, there's going to be some expectation. And at Sporting, he's dealt with, fairly high level of expectation in terms of delivering titles. And the main thing with Liverpool is, they did finish fifth in the league last season. Of course, that was Klopp. And they are going to drop off, make no mistake. They should not be in this title race. Like, they're in this title race with absolute, half the team is kids. They should barely be in, the top four, on level-wise. But it's a fantastic job that team and the coaching staff are doing. But whoever's going to come in next is not going to have them in the title race. I think if you appreciate that, I think Amorim is a fair shout. But hold on a second. Varun has his hand up.
I think before that, I need to go back. Because I think the thing I've disagreed with you most on the podcast. I think you're right in saying that they could be, they shouldn't be in the title race, a bunch of kids. Liverpool fans, I'm thinking that. They're just coming off the era of Jurgen Klopp dominance. They're not going to accept someone coming in and getting them to finish fifth. That's going to be everyone in the media saying they're doing terribly. I don't think logic can apply there.
But then by that logic, no, Liverpool shouldn't get anyone in, because I don't think anyone can come in and keep them in a title race. Who do you think? That's a different topic.
I think there's someone more likely to than Amorim, who's never had experience in a top five league. There's loads of concerns we've just laid out. If for his career, that's a giant risk. You're the Jurgen Klopp successor. You could become the David Moyes. I think that's a giant risk. Why not go to a lower team where you have room to make mistakes, and then you've got you'll definitely get more time before you get sacked. You won't have to be breaking down low blocks all the time. You can do more of what we said, setting up the good mid block. You said yourself, his team would come to the Premier League and be more of a mid blocky team. You're not going to do that at Liverpool. Everyone's going to sit back against you.
To be fair, I don't think he should be Liverpool's first choice. Let's have fun.
I've been having a lot of fun listening to this. I'm actually right bang in the middle of both of you. I don't share Alex's pessimism that he's that he's West Ham level or he needs a mid-table club. I don't think it's that bad. But I also don't agree he should take over Liverpool. I agree with Alex in the sense that I think something like a Liverpool just becomes a bit big, a bit too quick, a bit too early for him. I would say there are options in between. I mean, it doesn't have to be these two extremes. Like if Alonso leaves Leverkusen is a decent job. Option. Yeah, I mean, you're not the league leader. Bayern's up there. And you, Dortmund, and Leipzig. Something like that. And I know Pioli is not leaving Milan. And I think Roma are doing well with De Rossi. Napoli is always confused, so I don't know. But one of those clubs also...
Napoli because that's a train wreck.
Yeah, Napoli is a train wreck for other reasons because of the management and stuff. Yeah, but I think that range of clubs which are top four competing, but they don't have league leader pressure. Like, I don't think he should go to Barcelona, Liverpool, United as well. I mean, all said and done, United is a top four.
United.
Yeah, United is a top four club, but in the sense that they spend a lot and they have big expectations, it just won't last 2 years. But yeah, a team that is a little more patient, which doesn't have league leader resources, is like second, third or fourth in terms of finances and can punch up a bit and Amorim can learn a bit. That kind of team, like a Leverkusen, Roma, if they hadn't got De Rossi, I don't think he should go to any of the Barca, Liverpool, United, Madrid, this class of club. Like, just one below tier one, I think, is perfect for him at this point. He has potential. He can work on his stuff. And then maybe his next move can be that. Like, if he does really well at a Leverkusen for 2 or 3 years, then why not a Barca or a Madrid or a Liverpool after that? So I think that would be a better transition.
I know we're in a bit of a rush, but just to defend that West Ham shout, because I actually view them more as that lower tier one. Well, no, I can defend that very easily. I think, yeah, the perception is, you know, like mid-table to relegation team. I've been forgetting they've been in Europe nearly all the last years. They've also been one of the Premier League's biggest spenders. Their player quality right now, like, they're not a, for lack of a better word, crap team. But they've got, like, some very good players in Lucas Paqueta. I think Edson Alvarez is pretty good as well. Mohamed Kudus too, Jared Bowen, like, and Moyes been leaving the summer. I think he'd get a lot of time to turn that team from, you know, Moyes football into more possession football. I actually don't think that's anywhere near as a bad shout as like it might seem. I mean, West Ham should be regarded a bit higher than maybe what our perception is, which is I was basically aiming for what Varun was saying. He should be that sort of, like, you know, just below tier one. Like, you should be going for a team that's aspiring to get into Europe, but not one that already wants to maintain their position there.
I mean, I agree on West Ham should be...
I
agree on Alex's angle of West Ham specifically, that they are the eighth biggest wage bill in the league, right? Only the top six and Aston Villa, the rich six, let's put it that. The rich six and Aston Villa are above West Ham, you know. So they spend well. They have a lot of quality in attack. Honestly, any decent manager, if he can come and get a centre back or a midfielder or, you know, just one or two tweaks in, or a striker, actually, they can aim for a sixth or seventh. But then it won't go beyond that. They're not going to go beyond sixth or seventh. And I just think Amorim is a little bit better than that. I agree on West Ham, but I think Amorim deserves a little better. He deserves one of those second, third, fourth, fifth kind of clubs who can maybe win a title if they have a good year. Something like, you know, a Leverkusen.
That's a fair take.
I think we have to appreciate that he has been for the last 4 years doing a pretty good job at the one of the top teams in the sixth or seventh best league in the world.
I mean, I appreciate that. I think the point of difference is that I think you guys are fan casting him on the, like, what he deserves. I'm fan casting him on what he should do for the best of the interest of his career.
Yeah, I agree. From that perspective,
I'd put him in maybe the Ange.
I think West Ham is not good for his career, to be fair, at the same time.
Yeah, I'd put him in the Ange Postecoglou bracket, who also did really well with Celtic. But that doesn't mean, you know, Liverpool or Madrid or Barcelona. It meant Tottenham. It meant a sixth or seventh place team.
Yeah.
And a 3-4 year, yeah, 5 year project.
Eric Ten Hag went from Ajax. I mean, obviously, it didn't end well. But in theory, I mean, because Celtic is Scottish Premiership, which is not quite the same level as Eredivisie or Premier League. Eric Ten Hag went Ajax to Manchester United. So I'm going to stand by the fact that I think, I would actually say this, I agree with Alex on the point of, from Amorim's perspective, it's probably not the best idea. Probably with Liverpool's perspective, if you don't get Xabi Alonso, I'm trying to think back to a Liverpool episode. Who was our backup shout?
Nagelsmann.
Yes. Which I think is a much more solidified challenge than Perfect.
Yeah.
I agree. But I think third choice.
I was about to say, we've seen the third choice. And there we have it.
But no, see, I mean, I just don't think Eredivisie, Premier Liga, Scottish League, a league leader from these leagues shouldn't go to a league leader to the top five leagues. Like, I don't think Ten Hag...
It's a risk, but I think it's doable.
Like you're not going to ask Peter Bosch to go to a league leader team right now. He's bossing that league.
Yeah, but that's a whole different...
Can
we think of a manager who's led one of those leagues that's come to the Premier League for a top team and done well?
Okay, that's a good question.
I don't think
that... Immediately, I think Erik ten Hag and Andre Vish Boas.
Yeah, that's a fair question, actually. Okay, who has...
I think Ten Hag would have benefited with a Europa level, but then he did get a Europa level team. So, I mean, yeah, that's a whole different thing. So let's not go there.
Next one. But no, actually, that's a fair question, Alex. And I can't think of any answer right now. Who managed Ajax before Ten Hag?
I mean, I'm currently looking at the background of Eredivisie winning managers, basically.
Okay, that's a good one as well. I'm going to go ask Peter Bosch. Still looking good.
Andre Villa Bosch went from Porto to Chelsea. Mourinho went from Porto to Chelsea.
Oh, yes, Mourinho is the big one. Yeah.
Yeah. But then he won a Champions League with Porto. So I think.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I mean, okay.
He was much better.
Please, yeah. Don't attack me because I was not in a physical state to understand football at the time. But when Mourinho went from Porto to Chelsea, were Chelsea like a title challenging team or were they like just a tier below?
No, I would say, so there were two factors here. One was Mourinho was pretty good with Porto. Like he beat Sir Alex's United. And I saw that game convincingly, right? Well coached. And second, Chelsea were probably the third highest spenders already. They were pressing that United Arsenal duopoly.
They were coming up.
They were the third highest spenders, and Mourinho got two windows, which United Arsenal couldn't have dreamt of. Those first two summer windows, they spent like crazy, and immediately Mourinho was able to make them a title challenging team. So I think level of manager and level of club spending both were pretty awesome in that case. With Villa's boss, I think it was a little more realistic. Chelsea had the money to spend and he had won a lot with Porto, but he wasn't like Mourinho level. And I think that's closer to what you might expect if an Amorim type went to a club that spends a lot and expects league titles, you know, and that's where I think it would get a little tough, because I don't think Villas Boas at that time was bad, but he was a bit more developmental. A Tottenham kind of move would have been better for him. The first time he went.
Yeah.
I wouldn't ask to report in with me, Neil, because I'm currently looking at Frank de Boer's Wikipedia.
I just thought that like de Boer is one of them, so.
Start looking good, yeah.
I don't think these league winning managers should go to a title expecting club in the top five leagues. So in that sense, I agree with Alex, but I just think mid table is too less. The Europa pushing Champions League slot kind of range would be really good.
Yeah, I really like Bayer Leverkusen. I think that's the best shot. I mean, obviously, if that's an opening, but yeah, if it is, then you should totally go for it. But yeah, I think, do we have any more shouts or shall we wrap it up here? I think we shall wrap it up here. So yes, thank you very much for listening, everyone. Thanks to you, Alex and Varun. You can find all of us on Twitter. I'm at Shilat Neil. Varun is Runsty at the Devil's DNA account, and Alex is at Euro_Expert_. And if you go to the @GetFootballEU account, you will find in the bio the links to all our country and league-specific handles, which you can follow to be updated with all that's going on in the world of football, especially in Europe, with analysis, news, videos, all sorts of stuff as we enter the very much the final stretch of the season in the Champions League and all these various leagues. So do follow those. You can find links to that in the notes or description of this episode as well, wherever you're listening. And yeah, if your app allows it, please do rate the podcast and give us 5 stars if you enjoyed it. And of course, feel free to share on socials as well. But thank you very much for listening. Thanks again, Alex and Varun. And we'll be back next week with hopefully less of a fight. Take care until then. Bye-bye.